Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
All right, here we go. Hey, everybody, welcome in. It's David Summers, and here comes another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. This is the story of wrestling in America, as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring and back into time as we get wall-to-wall, tree-top tall, with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, hanging out in the Smoky Mountains of Tennessee. Hey, Stud, your southeastern Gulf Coast territory was riding a real high in 1980. A good example was the huge crowds you drew in the last Studcast. So I have a question. I can't wait to ask, but first, I'd like to get this one started.
All right, hey, Dave, you know, obviously, seems like to me you're all saddled up, man, and ready to ride. So
why not?
And, you know, man, I like the questions. So although, you know, I don't normally, we don't normally start them this way, you kind of piqued my interest, man. So how about we go ahead and start this Studcast with your question, man?
Okay. I hope you don't mind, but I do have a question that's been bothering me since the last Studcast. In fact, since the last two Studcasts. In those Studcasts, two of your 1980 stars had been hurt and were suddenly gone. So losing guys like, I mean, not just guys, not just boys in the locker room, Joe LeDuc and Jimmy Golden, unexpectedly, they had to be potentially detrimental to the territory when you lose stars like that. So how did you manage that scary situation?
Well, it was pretty scary. That's a good way of putting it, you know, and that's a great question, Dave. And one all bookers, man, had to deal with. If you were a booker, you sooner or later, you're going to have to deal with stuff like this. So, and oddly enough, man, I was planning on doing today's hidden history lesson on bookers and booking and kind of the history behind them. So most fans had an interest in that subject. I get a lot of questions about bookers and doing booking. And in April of 1980, they had the loss of these two stars that you just mentioned. And it could easily kill the momentum that we had created in the first 3 months of that year. We'd been working on trying to get that thing cranked up big time down there. So let's get right into the Studcast, man, with an answer to that question. And then we'll take a much deeper dive, man, into the history of why there was even a need to have bookers in the sport. So, in fact, it fits perfectly with the second half of this Studcast, so which is going to be about the card that followed the injury of Joe LeDuc and Jimmy Golden, and a card that required, obviously, the next card after that one, required a creative booker, man, coming up with one match in particular that was going to be uniquely filled with special stipulations. That going forward, we're going to greatly affect the territory down there. So let's answer your question. So how was I as the booker going to handle the unexpected loss of both Joe LeDuc and Jimmy Golden? And thank goodness, man, from top to bottom, we had a very strong crew, and we were coming off some very big weeks. We had a lot of good momentum with the territory that was clearly headed in the right direction at that point. And I luckily had already touched on one of the answers to your question in the last Studcast. I got the two guys in the crew on TV, that had been overlooked for many weeks, both of which had the potential to step up and at least partially fill the shoes that we had lost with Golden and Leduc. So, you know, we got it started in that direction early.
Okay, so you must be talking about Eddie Boulder, the future Brutus the Barber Beefcake, and Randy Rose, the steadily improving heel who had started making a name for himself in a big way, in the angle, especially with the Wrestling Pro, and then followed that working against Tony Charles for several weeks.
Yeah, very good, Dave. I mean, you picked up on their involvement in the last TV show, and that was the two guys that I was talking about. And there was also another pair of wrestlers in the crew that had been in the business even longer than Boulder and Rose, and they were very capable of taking up the slack left by these unexpected injuries. And those two guys were Charlie Cook and Norvell Austin, and they were going to be getting some TV airtime in this studcast.
Okay, so I can see that. I mean, that makes sense. Charlie Cook was just coming off a month-long run of matches with Don Fargo. Norvell Austin was coming off a run with Tony Charles, in which he had become the U.S. Junior Heavyweight Champion.
Right. So, you know, that was why good bookers tried to fill their territory with great talent. If they got into trouble, potential trouble like that had happened with losing those two guys back to back, they had guys they could depend on to fill the holes. So those four wrestlers were going to be called upon as an experienced booker. That was just the beginning of a card that I designed to bring the fans back in spite of the loss of the two stars in the 2 weeks. So before we finish the other things that I thought of, for that critical card, let's take a giant step back, Dave, on this entire subject of bookers, to the history of why there was even a need for bookers at all. And when you think about it, until the Gold Dust Trio, which was Ed Strangler Lewis, Billy Sandow, and Joseph Tootsmont, came along in the 1920s, there was no need for bookers. The sport was legitimate, and rarely ever had been there more than one match on a card. So, it was a totally different animal until the 1920s. The Gold Dust Trio, they changed all of it. By adding more than one match to a card and by taking control of who was going to win or lose, there was a great need all of a sudden for bookers. The sport had changed instantly from having these long and boring matches that lasted hours with very little action, and the winners being the most important thing in the match. It suddenly went to suddenly shorter matches with much more action, many more wrestlers involved in the event. No single person had control of the match when it was legit. The booker came, and that was the controlling guy when things were going to change. So for the next 15 years, basically until about after 1930, all the way during the Depression and through World War II, the sport saw very few changes. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, professional wrestling was about to explode in popularity, mostly due to the invention of television. So wrestling was also, also went from 2 out of 3 fall matches at that point to 1 fall matches, and cards grew from one match to 3, some places probably 4 matches by the late 40s, early 50s. So in the latter 50s, the number of professional wrestlers themselves grew by hundreds, and the number of bookers obviously grew as well. So bookers became responsible for gimmicks like Gorgeous George, the French Angel, Killer Karl Kowalski, the German Von Bronners, managed by Saul Weingroff, to name a few of those. And bookers were also coming up with gimmick matches, like tag matches came in the early 40s, late 30s, early 40s. Then you had notice qualification matches the bookers came up with, battle royals, and then all kinds of death matches. Bookers were trying to get very, very creative and trying to pump the business even more. And the times were changing overnight, and so were bookers. Each one of them, they had their own style of booking. And they freely were copying everybody else's ideas as well, right? They would see this match that happened in some other territory, and they were like, wow, I'm going to use that in mine. So bookers preferred, you know, some of them like big wrestlers, like those in the northeastern part of the country, up in the New York and up the East Coast there. They like the big guys, man. And other bookers preferred smaller men that could move quickly around the ring, bounce off the ropes, throw drop kicks, fly around like Antonio Rocca, Superfly Snuka, you know. So then other bookers preferred those guys that had real wrestling backgrounds, like Danny Hodge and Hiro Matsuda, Dale Lewis, Jack Briscoe. I mean, you had all these great amateur wrestlers that were getting involved. So, you know, bookers were basically, man, as varied as their preferences for the talent that they were going to get. And they had their differences, obviously, the talent in all different styles of wrestling, you know. And so a booker's success at making the right choices of wrestlers was going to be critical to that booker's future. Mm. It was a big-time pressure job, no doubt about that, being a booker. The better you did and at filling the buildings, the better opportunities you were going to get in the future as you continued your success, if you had success as a booker. Mm. And it wasn't uncommon for a great booker to make as much each week as the top wrestler in the territory booked, Dave.
Mm. All right, so I've kind of had an idea, just knowing you and hearing you over the years, of how competitive bookers had to be and how important they were to the success of any wrestling company. How many bookers did you hire after buying the first Southeastern territory in Tennessee, for example? Like,
all right, well, I'll tell you what. I hired Louis Tillett, my first booker in Tennessee, 1975. And Louis was already a proven booker, actually in Georgia and in Florida. And when I was just a wrestler there in the early 1970s, and I spent a lot of time with Louis, and I realized that Louis had a lot of talent when it came to booking. Then in 1976, I let Louis go, and I hired my brother to take over the booking for me. And when we purchased the Gulf Coast territory down there in 1978, I began booking with Bob Armstrong as my assistant. In 1979, I hired Bob Roop to book the Tennessee territory, and I moved Robert South into the Southeastern Gulf Coast territory. The Memphis territory then quickly kind of stole my brother, and I had to replace him, and I replaced him with, guess who, Louis Tillett. You know, and he found Hulk Hogan and a heck of a lot of other guys and a lot of good talent. So because we had two territories in that year, you know, I was going to try to work both of those territories in 1979. It was going to be impossible for me to book. So it was a great deal for me to end up with Louis in the South and my brother, you know, my brother down there and had left and Louis was able to come in and take his job. So after I sold the Southeastern Knoxville territory, 1979, Robert and I took turns booking the Southeastern Gulf Coast down there. From 1980 all the way up to 1985, we alternated. Each year we took a year and then we took a year off as a booker. And I became the only booker in 1985 after that. For the other two companies that I developed, Continental Wrestling and for USA Wrestling in 1988. So there's quite a few bookers that ran through the territories.
Well, I'm curious, obviously you've worked with a lot of folks over so many years. Who would you consider to be some of the great bookers in the business?
Well, geez, I haven't spent most of my career in the South, you know, I'd prefer to kind of answer that based upon the part of the country that I knew a lot about. So I want to focus my attention on the South, let's say, best bookers in the South. And my father always booked his own territories. He started out on the Gulf Coast down there in the mid-1950s. From there, he went to Memphis. From there, we went to Arizona. From there, he went to Atlanta. And 1964, and he booked all of those territories himself. In Georgia, I would say, great bookers, Louis Tillett, I mentioned earlier, he booked in Georgia before going to Florida. Tom Renesto, one of the famous assassins, partners with Jody Hamilton, was a fabulous booker in Georgia. And he was followed by another fabulous booker, Bill Watts. In Florida, you had Eddie Graham, who was the, oh, what a mind he had for business, especially as a booker. Leo Garibaldi, one of the greatest bookers of all time, one of the great family, one of the greatest wrestling families of all time. And Dusty Rhodes came along in the end, started in 1974 as a babyface, and wow, was down there for 10 years doing just Florida alone. And then in the Gulf Coast, I'd have to say that Cowboy Bob Kelly, in that territory down there, did a great job back before we got control and bought the territory. Memphis had Jerry, and Georgia, I'd have to say Ole Anderson, who was, this was right before McMahon took over the Georgia territory. Wrestling changed entirely, but Ole Anderson was a heck of a booker.
Wow. It really sounds like a who's who of greats in the South, no doubt. So this has been quite a hidden history lesson, Stud. All right, so I'm wondering now, can we go back to where we started today with that creative card for the other things as Booker you thought necessary to be on it to replace Joe LeDuc and Jimmy Golden in 1980? So how do you do that?
Well, the first thing I had going to happen that I have not mentioned was I was going to add a match to all three major cities' cards. We had never had seven matches on a card before in the territory. And, just adding a match to the card was a great selling point for fans. But we were going to hammer that fact, too, with on our TV, that these was going to be seven-match cards. So, that was going to, I thought, help things tremendously. Not only was I going to do that, but on this coming show, I'm going to do it on the one afterward, too. So we're going to have two back-to-back seven-match cards to try to keep that momentum we had going. And we wanted to get that additional impact on that second show, so we had them two back-to-back. And that extra match especially was going to be meaningful. If we had the right person put in it. And so I had figured out who I wanted to do that with. And so the second thing I did was find the perfect wrestler for that added match. And that turned out to be Dick Steinborn. He was my choice. He had been a heel there in 1979. And I figured him right away into an angle for the next TV. So I got a couple of... I've got two sets of guys that are already in the crew that are going to be adding to things. I've got seven matches. Now I've got Dick Steinborn in one of those seven matches, and he's going to go on and be there for a few weeks. And I was also going to spice it up, and I say that, I use that term because that's kind of what a lot of bookers did. If they wanted to add a little bit of something extra special, I did on the next TV, I had both Randy Rose and the Eddie Boulder match, and I had Charlie Cook versus Norvell Austin, and I was going to bring those matches back on the following card as well. So I was pulling out a lot of stops, and as if that wasn't enough, I was going to highlight the Big C and Don Carson on TV by not allowing Don Carson in the arena on this next event, the one we're going to be talking about here in the latter part of the show. Mm-hmm. And I was going to put him and his future in Southeastern in great jeopardy with everything on the line, his Mongolian Stomper. If he lost his Southeastern Championship match, it was going to be the end for Don Carson. Plus, the Big C wasn't even going to be booked on the next big card.
All right, so you were not kidding about having a plan. You were throwing everything on that card but the kitchen sink. I can't wait to hear who was on it in all three of those major markets. Can you give us that card before we go to the break?
Yeah, sure, man. It was a totally different card than what the last three cards were. We'd had those eight-man tags, and this one is just, I mean, it has no similarities. It was the first seven-match card, like I mentioned, in Southeastern Wrestling history, and it also had a triple main event on it, three different main events. So in the opening match, Roy Lee Welch was facing the guy I just talked about, Dick Steinborn, who was coming out of Orlando, Florida. He lived in Orlando. He was going to stay with us for a little bit. And so he opened the match, and he's obviously going to get himself a big win. The popular Ricky Fields, with the win the week before, we brought him, we booked him with Bill Dromo, which was a big guy against a little small, tiny Ricky Fields, but there's going to be a surprise in that match, too. For the first time ever, Charlie Cook was going to go up against Norvell Lawson. Those two guys had never wrestled against each other. Randy Rose was going to be facing Eddie Boulder. They had a 20-minute time limit draw the week before, and both men, ended up fighting after the end of that. This time, they're going to be wrestling in a no-time-limit match. Then there's first of three main events. First one was for the United States Junior Championship. Tony Charles had just regained his belt from Norvell Austin the week before. He was going to be defending it against, for the first time ever, the fabulous Don Fargo. Those two guys have never wrestled in their careers. For the Southeastern Tag Championship, Rob and I were still champions, but we hadn't defended the championship for 5 weeks. So we're going to be wrestling against two men from Texas, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin. The last match of the night was for the Southeastern Championship. It was the Mongolian Stomper versus the Georgia Jawjacker, and it had several special stipulations in it, things that we had never done before. So one of them was, if the Georgia Jawjacker won, he could have his choice. He could either unmask, and if he was Bob Armstrong and he wanted to stay in Southeastern, he could either keep the mask on, continue wrestling as a Georgia Jawjacker, or not have to wear the mask anymore. So plus his win would assure that Don Carson, if Stomper lost that match, Don Carson had to leave Southeastern for an entire year. And then, if the champion Mongolian Stomper won, the Georgia Jawjacker was going to have to unmask. And if he was Bob Armstrong, Bob Armstrong was going to have to leave Southeastern Wrestling forever.
All right, that's a tremendous card right there. Three title matches, one of which was going to have a big effect on the territory for a long time, I'm talking. Plus, the first time ever, a seven-match card in Southeastern. So, with this kind of card, I can't wait to hear about the TV show that set it all up. And let's do that when we come back after the break. Stay with us, Studcast fans. We'll be right back. Super Studcast are hot again. Ron's 43 Classic 3-Hour Super Studcast for only $2.99 each have always been special, but are suddenly the talk of the sport. Find all 43 at tnstud.com. Click Super Studcast and take your pick of some of the best wrestling history in the world. From Andre the Giant to Bill Watts, Mick Foley to Jim Cornette, and Bob Armstrong to Terry Funk and Stan Hansen. There's nothing like it. From the slap heard round the world, Dr. D. David Schultz, to Kevin Sullivan, it's only the beginning. A veritable who's who of wrestling, live for only $2.99 each. TNStud.com takes you to wrestling paradise. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back into another Studcast. This is episode number 347, The History of Bookers Create Miracles. That's the title of this one. All right, Ron, this card was loaded. So who and what was going to start the TV show? Set it up for us.
Well, Charlie Platt opened the show with Tony Charles at the set. Tony had his belt with him. He had just won it back from Norvell Austin. And he was going to be there to do the commentary because, his opponent's going to be in the ring. So And he had successfully, like I said, won it back the week before from Norvell Austin. Tony was going to get what he asked Don Curtis, the Southeastern Commissioner, for the week before, that if he won his belt back, he wanted to defend it next against the fabulous Don Fargo, because Fargo had popped him in the eye with the brass knucks. And, you know, and he basically said, if I win my belt back, I want Don Fargo. So he's basically asking for his opponent, picking his opponent. And he had never wrestled Don Fargo before. And he wanted to wrestle him because of what had happened in the ring where Fargo whacked him with the brass knucks.
All right. So the first TV match, who was in that one?
For Don Fargo. You know, so the show started off a little bit differently right away than what we had been doing on TV. And Fargo, as soon as he got in the ring, he saw Tony Charles sitting over there at the set, who was already there before he got to the ring, and he started screaming challenges for him. He started screaming, you know, like, why don't you come on up here, man? Why don't we just have the championship match now? You know, let's get this thing on. So when the scheduled TV match finally started, an unexpected guest arrived at the set, and that was Dick Steinborn. And I mentioned him earlier in the studcast, and he hadn't been seen in Southeastern for 9 months. He hadn't been there since 1979, pretty early summer, 1979. So he came around to the front of the desk where Tony and Charlie were sitting. And he reached over and he grabbed Tony's microphone and he began to make his own challenge for a United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match. You know, and he was saying that he was only there to win the belt and that he didn't care. He didn't give a darn about being in that part of the country. But if he got that belt, he was going to leave as quick as he got there. He was going to be coming to win his Tony's belt and be gone with it. So, you know, Tony been through a lot of opponents in this short period of time over the last couple of months there. He had gone through the great Mephisto. He dealt with Randy Rose. He had dealt with Norvell Austin. And you know, and then to kind of had his frustration with the fact, you know, of what was going on now. He's being challenged. He's actually being challenged by Fargo in the ring, and he's got the Dick Steinborn challenging him right there at the set. So, you know, so Rob and I, we're watching this back in the dressing room, and I remember, you know, we both got a little big, got a little pop out of what Tony said. Tony, you know, he's gotten challenged by Steinborn, and he says, you know, he grabbed Tony's microphone because Steinborn still got his microphone. And he says to Steinborn, he says, get in line, Steinborn.
All right. So wasn't there a match going on in the ring while this was happening?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a match going on and there's about to be one out at the set. So the show's director, who was Wayne Register, great director, he did an excellent job. He got a split screen, man. It's a great split screen screenshot. Fargo was up there pounding his opponent in the ring, and on the other side of the screen, and the other side of everybody's screen that was at home, you know, there was Steinborn and making his push to get the match with Tony Charles. So you know, Charlie, you know, and so then Steinborn, Fargo's up there and he sees what's going on. And, you know, I can understand be a little concerned. What's this all about? Is he trying to get my match? And so he just pretty quickly finished his opponent and he jumped out of the ring and he went straight to Steinborn, spun him around and they got face to face. And so Charlie's like, what in the heck? He goes, hey, you know, you guys get it, break it up. And then, you know, they were about to get into it. And, you know, Charlie said, let's go to black. He didn't want anybody seeing another match. So got a pretty crazy little beginning to this. So then Tony grabbed his championship belt. And on the way out, he said to Charlie, he said, you know, I really don't care which one of those two blokes win this argument. He goes, because neither one of them can beat me anyway. And he left the set. So Charlie called for the break, like I said, and they were still face to face, and they never got into it, but they were pretty close.
A cool deal. Not only was the card for the next week very different from the last ones, but the TV show started out completely different too. All right, so who was in the next segment?
Well, Norvell was at the set with Charlie in this next one, and he was going to watch Charlie Cook, his next opponent, wrestling in the next match. So, and very strange, man. These guys had been in territories up in Knoxville, and now they're down there, and these guys had never wrestled against each other. Pretty amazing. So, you know, I wanted to put them together and just see what kind of match they would have. Both of them were great wrestlers. And so Cook was in the ring, and it was a good thing he was in the ring, and he couldn't hear what Norvell had to say about it. So Norvell's down there with Charlie, and he's having a field day, man. And he says that, you know, Charlie Cook, he says, you know, he's a total disgrace, he said to Charlie as a football player, you know. And he said he missed more tackles in 9 years for the Pittsburgh Steelers than a linebacker in NFL history. And he said, you know, and then he said, you know, he says, I'm going to prove to everybody in this first match I ever had against Charlie Cook that he's one of the sorriest athletes in America. Yes. And, you know, thank goodness, like I said, Charlie couldn't hear what was happening. So when Cook got the win in the match, Norvell jumped up from the set, and he went straight to the ring, and he got right in Charlie Cook's face. And, you know, and it was kind of similar to what had happened in the first match. Fargo and Steinbrenner face to face, and now we got a problem with Cook and Norvell. So, you know, you couldn't hear what Norvell was saying to Charlie, but boy, you could definitely hear the big right hand that Charlie Cook landed on the side of his head. Pow! I mean, he popped him, and Austin went flying through the ropes out on the concrete. And boy, Charlie left the ring with a standing ovation from the studio crowd.
Okay, this TV show was off to a great start. So who and what was on the personality profile, Stud?
Well, it was a special one, man. Actually, it was done in two parts. It was done that way because we were going to cover all these special stipulations involved in this upcoming Southeastern Championship match between the Stomper and the Georgia Jawjacker. And so prior to the fans coming into the studio, when Charlie got there, obviously the Jawjacker was there early, they spent some time and they recorded, pre-recorded the Jawjacker's comments that were going to be shown to Carson in the actual personality profile itself. And this match, I think, Dave, was one of the most important matches in Southeastern wrestling history. I mean, wow, it really had fantastic stipulations to it. Going to change things. So that recording was going to be shown to everybody, including Carson, Mongolian Stomper, live in this show, in the personality profile. So none of the three guys who were involved in the match had any idea what the stipulations were in the match. So, you know, Carson didn't know when he sat down there what the deal was. Neither did the Jawjacker. So, you know, and the Jawjacker had a little bit of problem when he heard it too, about, whoa, geez. So the recording was going to show, you know, like I said, live in the show, and then everybody's going to find out what the stipulations are in this match. So the profile opened up with Charlie and Don Carson. They were sitting in the big profile chairs. Mongolian Stomper was behind Carson, and he had that big old huge truck shock again, and he was just cranking that thing. He was sweating like crazy. This kind of reminded me of him doing the sit-up deal, where he was just, he looked like he had been working on that shock for 30 minutes. And Charlie started things off, and he explained that he had talked earlier about this historic upcoming Southeastern title match with the Georgia Jawjacker, and that he wanted Don Carson to have a chance to see it before he got any comments from him. You know, he wanted him to see what the Jawjacker had to say. So this pre-recorded interview was all about the special stipulations put on this match. And it was the first, and the match for the Southeastern Championship was, that was the foremost thing going here, man. These two guys had had several matches for the championship, but nothing that was important as this. So you couldn't see the face of the Jawjacker, but because he's wearing a mask, but you could darn sure hear the concern in his voice when Charlie did this opening with him, and he told him what was going to happen, you know, in this upcoming championship match. And he told him if he lost, he was going to have to remove his mask. And if he was Bob Armstrong, he was going to be banned from Southeastern wrestling forever, never to wrestle in Southeastern again. So, you know, I mean, wow. And that's what I said, you know, Bob was like, whoa, no, my God. So the studio audience, you know, they let out a gasp of shock. I mean, obviously, they weren't expecting anything like that. Neither was the Jawjacker. So Don Carson jumped to his feet, man. He just exploded. He dropped, and the Stomper threw his shock down on the floor, and they started hugging each other and patting each other on the back, high-fiving, man, hot dog. We got it. So Carson told Charlie, you know, he said, this is what we've been asking for. He goes, you know, my Stomper deserved, since he beat Bob Armstrong in a loser leave match months ago, that not to have to wrestle somebody else. And then he says, Don, you know, Bob Armstrong comes back here as the Georgia Jawjacker. And everybody knows the Georgia Jawjacker is really Bob Armstrong. You know, and he was just, wow, this is great. So the studio was still kind of buzzing, man, about this potential bad news for the Jawjacker. And so Charlie asked Carson, he said, just sit back down here, Don. Well, I'm not finished, right? He said, you know, he says, now it's time for you to hear the potential bad news. So he says, in this upcoming match, and then he said, in every other match on this upcoming card, he goes, you're banned from the building. And he said, your good friend, Big C, he's not even on the card. So the TV crowd, they popped right there. You know, wow, what's going to happen in this? So you could see Carson kind of swallowed hard, you know, because Charlie wasn't through. And then he said, if the Mongolian Stomper loses this title match, he says, there's one more thing that's going to happen to you. And he says, you're going to be banished from Southeastern Wrestling for an entire year. Then there was an explosion, man. not just Carson, but from the studio crowd, too. They exploded. They went crazy. They loved it, and Carson hated it. So the fans, the celebration, it lasted a lot longer than the Carson and Stomper's little short celebration had been. So Carson was screaming to Charlie. He said, they can't do that to me, Charlie Platt. I mean, whose idea is this? It's not fair. He goes, I can't even be in the building for the match. And he says, and if my Stomper loses, I have to leave for a whole year. So it didn't make much difference to Charlie, because I think he was prepared for getting some kind of big blowback from him. So Charlie had already left the seat. He was headed back to the main set. Carson was screaming at him from one side of the studio to the other, going nuts over there about this bad news. So everyone on the bleachers, they were still going wild. They were still having a good time.
That's a classic personality profile. It's hard to follow that. All right, but what was next?
Eddie Boulder was getting in the ring for his second TV match in 2 weeks. He had been on last week, too. Randy Rose was going to the set to join Charlie to have some comments about his match, his upcoming no time limit match with Boulder. And so they talked about it being a no time limit match after the 20-minute deal, and that the guys had continued fighting after the 20 minutes ran out last time. And this time there was going to be nobody, no time limit on it. And they were going to be returning next week, obviously, in a no-time limit match. So they were also headed to big futures, these two guys. Eddie Boulder going to end up being Brutus the Barber Beefcake years down the road. And Randy Rose was one of the founding members of the Midnight Express. And the Midnight Express This is pretty strange, but I looked this up. Then Midnight Express is the longest running tag team in the sports history.
You know, I think I've heard that, Stud, and maybe it was you that mentioned that before, but I knew there were a lot of different combinations of teams that used that name, but I had no idea that name had been that popular. So how did Boulder do in this TV match?
Well, he was doing fine, man, until Rose decided that he didn't like what he was seeing. So, you know, and he had his say about Boulder, and then he saw what was happening, and then all of a sudden he just left the set, slid into the ring, threw Boulder's opponent over the top rope, knocked the referee down, and he had his street clothes on. He pulled something out of his pants pocket, and boy, he popped Boulder with it, and it opened him up like a tin can, man. I mean, wow, it was nasty looking. And if they didn't already have a reason to dislike each other, they sure did now at this point. So it took two referees, Bill Dromo from out of the dressing room, to get Rose out of the ring, and Boulder was bleeding pretty badly, man. It was a nasty little deal.
Obviously a pretty wild TV show that this was becoming, no doubt. All right, so how about the last match? Who was in that one?
Well, Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin. And I call them the Texas Cowboys because they always had their ropes with them. I mean, you know, Bass had his bull rope with the bell on it, and Bill Irwin all had his lasso. And so Rob and I were facing the two of them the next week. We were defending our Southeastern tag belts. Basically, for the first time, we had defended the belts in 5 weeks. So we were to set with Charlie, and we watched the end of that sad 8-man cage match where Joe LeDuc was attacked by Ron Bass with his bull rope for the second time in 4 days. And this time, 1 week ago, it happened on TV. So, you know, this is 4 days, you get popped with that bell and knocked unconscious in both of those matches. So on this video from Mobile, the night we were in the main arena, we had 9,000 fans. Joe ended up going to the hospital for his second concussion in 4 days. And wow, they told him, you don't need to be doing this, man. You're going to have to take some time off, or this is extremely dangerous, which it is. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, people didn't realize, athletes didn't realize how horrible concussions could be. You know, you could end up with real mental problems for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So Joe LeDuc was basically told you need to be off for 10 weeks.
Wow.
You don't need to be wrestling for 10 weeks. So wow. Basically, then Bass and Irvin, they were, wow, what an impressive team they were. I mean, me and Rob was like, wow, these guys are good. And both of them were almost 300 pounds. And they were full of angry, I guess is a good way of putting it. They were always nasty, man. And it definitely showed, man, in this, which was their first, like everything else, practically, all these guys wrestling each other never had. This is the first time these two guys had ever wrestled as a team. So there were a whole lot of firsts in this TV show, and it wasn't over yet. And what happened is when Charlie they won the match, and Charlie was closing out the show, and here comes the mask, Big C, shows up at the set, and he's very upset, man. He's mad, you know. He wanted to know, you know, what had happened to Don Carson earlier in the show. Why are they doing that to him, right? Well, you know, everybody knows that the Big C is Don Carson, but, you know, there he is with his mask on and his glove. And, you know, and he said he couldn't believe Southeastern would do something like this, you know. He banned Don Carson from the building. And he goes, and then they don't even put a star like me on the card. I'm not even on the card at all. So then he ended up by finishing just before they closed out the show. He had to make a threat. And he said, you know, Don Curtis, Southeastern Wrestling, goes, you made one big mistake, though. You know, he said, you didn't ban me from the building. You banned Carson from the building, right? And he says, I'm going to be there. And he says, I guarantee that Southeastern is going to be very sorry for this, because Bob Armstrong is going to be gone from here forever.
That had to be one of the best TV shows in Southeastern history, maybe. All right, so what happened in the buildings the next week with this spectacular card?
Well, Dick Steinborn got a win over Roy Lee Welts in the first of the seven matches. Ricky Fields got a win over Bill Dromo, which, wow, they popped in Mobile, man. They loved that boy anyway, and gosh, he beat a guy who was almost 100 pounds heavier than he was. Charlie Cook and Norvell Austin, they locked horns, man, literally, in the very first ever match against each other, you know, and it turned out to be a match of who had the hardest head, man. You know, because the Norvell liked to do those headbutts, and Charlie Cook had a pretty hard head, too. And they ended up headbutting each other until the end of the match. They both couldn't get up. They were both laying there, and neither one of them could pin the other one, so they both got counted out. Headbutted themselves out of victory. And so then Eddie Boulder showed up for revenge in his match with Randy Rose. And so, you know, after what happened on TV, you couldn't blame him for that. And this time it was Randy Rose that ended up bleeding in this match. And there was no winner. And then, you know, they stopped the match, disqualified both men. And they were going to end up coming back against each other the following week, Texas Death Match. Then the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship match between the champion Tony Charles and Don Fargo was a very interesting one, Dave. I'm telling you, this was pretty cool. It was a kind of like what had happened on TV 3 days before this match when Dick Steinborn showed up. So this time in the ring, after the announcements were made and the bell was rang and the match is about to begin to start, Steinborn and Fargo, here came Dick Steinborn down to the ring. And, Steinborn could... got in the ring and he confronted Tony Charles and Fargo's kind of standing back and said, what's going on here, right? And then Fargo didn't like being upstaged and so he tore into Steinborn and the two of them got into a heck of a fight, right? And naturally the crowd was enjoying this. So Tony Charles, he's still holding his belt. He's got the belt at stake in the match. He just went over to his corner, climbed up and sat down on the top turnbuckle, and he just watched him fight. Right? So he sat up there and watched him fight, and then both Fargo and Steinborn, they got bloody, and, they were having, then they finally had a double knockout. Steinborn went flying out of the ring, and Fargo went down in the middle of the ring, and so Tony just got down off the turnbuckle, walked over, wow, and pinned him. 1, 2, 3. I've never seen anything like that one.
Wow, I've never seen anything like that either. Tony didn't even break a sweat and kept his belt. So what happened to Fargo and Steinborn?
Well, they were going to be coming back against each other the next week. So they're going to get plenty of each other, man. And then the winner of that match the following week then is going to get a shot at Tony Charles again. So, it was a pretty convoluted mess, man, of what was going on. So in the meantime, the following week, Tony was going to be defending his belt against a local guy. And I'm sure you know something about this dude, a fan favorite in that part of the country for a long time, Greg Peterson.
Yeah, no doubt. He was one of my favorites. I bet that was a great match. And those two heels going at it the next week against each other. So you really were keeping the momentum going on this show. So what happened in the last two matches?
Well, in the Southeastern Tag Championship match, the Big C, true to his word on TV, he did show up at ringside. And he not only showed up, but he came down to the ring with Ron Bass and Dr. Bill Irwin against me and Rob. We were the champions. And true to his word again, he had a major part, man, in this match. And he managed to hit Rob with his loaded glove behind the referee's back. And he got a win for Bass and Irwin. And they walked out of there with the belts. So the seventh match of the night was one of the biggest in Southeastern history. An absolutely phenomenal match. I mean, wow, that building was packed, that record crowd. So the Big C was there again in the corner with the Mongolian Stomper. And it was absolutely electric in that building, man. There was so much at stake in this match. So the Georgia Jawjacker ended up bleeding through his mask, and it appeared that he was going to lose, man. And he was over there in the corner where Big C had been standing the whole match. He was knocked down and trying to get to his feet, and so the Stomper drew the referee away to the far corner. And that put Big C right there. He loaded up his glove, and he was about to finish the Jawjacker behind the referee's back, just like he had done the match before with Rob. And I was watching the match back there, and I saw it coming, man. I said, wait a minute, I've seen this already. And, it cost Rob and I our belts, so I grabbed myself a steel chair, and I went down the heels aisle, man, to the ring. And the Jawjacker, had his head leaned out over the middle rope. And he was in a perfect position for Big C to deliver the coup de grace, man. And Big C loaded that fist up, the old glove up, but he never saw me coming. And I hit him from behind with that chair over the head, and the roof came off that building, man. Stomper charged across the ring, and he reached through the ropes for me, and Georgia Jawjacker just kind of schoolboyed him, boyed him from behind. Little move, he just pulled him over his body and held him there for the pin. And the roof came off again, man. So Stomper got out of the ring. He went out there to help Big C, who wasn't getting up. He was down and out. And Bass and Irwin, they came down because the fans, they were mad. They were mad at what happened in my match with me and Rob in the tag match. So they were upset still. They kind of went down there to make sure Big C didn't get in trouble with or the Stomper either. So and Charlie Platt had come over from Dothan, man, to see this. And so Charlie came up and got in the ring. Mm-hmm. And so I was there, helping the Jawjacker kind of try to get himself together here, Charlie got him up, and he congratulated him for the win. And he added, he said, now Don Carson is banished from Southeastern for 1 year. And wow, that got another big pop. And so then Charlie asked the Jawjacker, he said, have you made up your mind about what you want to do? You want to keep your mask on? Or do you want to give it up? He says, and if that Bob Armstrong is under there, then you have your choice of what you wanted to do. So the old Jawjacker, he says, I think the Georgia Jawjacker has done his job. And he said, it's time for Bob Armstrong to come home. Wow. And he took that mask off and he threw it right straight up toward the roof of that building. And that crowd went crazy, man. What a pop there was. And they carried me and Bob on their shoulders, the fans, back to the dressing room.
Wow. I wish I'd seen that live. Wrestling is nothing like that anymore. What a great card and a great night. So how about the attendances in the three major markets? Had to be big.
Well, it wasn't only a great night, Dave, but it was a great week. I mean, Montgomery followed that 8-man tag cage match from the week before. They had 4,500 the week before, 4,500 again. Dothan was the same it is. It had been the week before, too, with 5,000 people. Mobile, we were in that smaller expo hall. We weren't in that 10,000-seat main arena, so we couldn't do that kind of big crowd like we'd done the week before. But we set a record for the expo hall, that smaller building. We put 6,000 people into that expo hall.
All right, Stud, I now see why you picked the title for this one. History of Bookers Create Miracles. You did just that in the third week of April of 1980. All right, sorry, but we're short on time, so no learning tree question today. Hopefully we'll get back to that next week. This has really been an excellent ride into wrestling history. So where are we going to be riding next week, Stud?
Well, we're going to have another man hidden history lesson, one very hidden from the fans, for sure. We're going to start discussing the prospects of expansion, man, and we're going to be taking a look at the beginning of our conversations with Nick Gulas about Southeastern possibly buying the rights to the remainder of the state of Alabama. So it was going to change everything for Southeastern, and eventually it was going to lead to the first remote TV production from a major arena in the history of the sport. So, should be a really good hidden history lesson next week. And we'll also be discussing the next seven-match card. The following week, we're going to have another one with seven matches. And this one has all seven matches are going to be meaningful. I mean, and that's pretty hard to do as a booker. Mm-hmm. To have every match on the card mean something.
Yeah.
So, and then hopefully, Dave, we'll get to a learning tree question next week.
That would be cool. All right, so folks, you know how to hook up with the Stud on Facebook. Find Ron at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like and follow him there and automatically become friends with a living legend. On Twitter or X, he's at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there also. Whatever he posts on Facebook is also posted on Twitter and vice versa. Check out the fantastic website at tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the Stud Store, where you can get 43 super studcasts, four different 8x10 photos, the thrilling Lion novel called Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirts. Still on sale, only $15.99. all with free shipping. And subscribe to Ron's YouTube channel, Southeastern Rewind, and find hundreds of hours of classic old school entertainment. The last 123 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, 115 short rides, and back 1 year or more, discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars, 23 studcast archive stories, 23 Tell Me More fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and much more. That's YouTube Southeastern Rewind on YouTube. All you do is go to the search bar, put in Southeastern Rewind. It's the first thing that pops up. It is the best deal in wrestling. All right. Any final comments, Ron?
Yeah, I'd like to thank everybody for listening, man, and I hope you enjoyed this one. And please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC. Thanks for joining us today for this historic studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.